It was only a little over an inch in diameter and no more than 2 feet long, but it would work as a thermos. She gently bent the broken pipe that remained down, allowing water to flow from the remaining loop. While she topped up her pipe, she splashed some water on her hands and arms, still fearful of contamination from the outside. Once her pipe was full, Juliet stole back toward the lit doorway at the end of the hall. There were 3 hydroponic farms, all with closed loops that wound through long and twisting corridors. She tried to do a rough calculation in her head, but all she could come up with was enough to drink for a very long time. The aftertaste was awful, and she wouldn't be surprised if her stomach cramped from the contents, but if she could get a fire going, find enough fabric or leftover paper to burn, even that could be helped with a good boil. Back in the stairwell, she returned to the rich odor she had left behind. She retrieved her knife and hurried down another thick slice of the silo, almost 2 times around the stairwell to the next landing, and checked the door. The smell was definitely coming from the dirt farms. And Juliet could hear that whirring again, louder now. She stopped the door and propped her thermos against the railing and checked inside. The smell of vegetation was overpowering. Ahead, in the dim green glow, she could see bushy arms reaching over the railings and into the pathway. She vaulted the security gate and explored the edge, one hand on the wall while her eyes adjusted again. There was definitely a pump running somewhere. She could also hear water dripping, either from a leak or a functioning tap. Juliet felt chills from the leaves brushing her arms. The smell of rot was distinguishable now. It was the odor of fruit and vegetables decaying in the soil and withering on the vine. She heard the buzz of flies, the sounds of life. She reached into a thick stand of green and felt around until her hand hit something smooth. Juliet gave it a tug and held a plump tomato up to the light. Her timeline estimate suddenly shrank. How long could the dirt farms sustain themselves? Did tomatoes require seeding, or did they come back every year like the weeds? She couldn't remember. She took a bite, the tomato not yet fully ripe, and heard a noise behind her. Another pump clicking on? She turned just in time to see the door to the stairwell slamming closed, plunging the dirt farm into absolute darkness. Juliet froze. She waited for the sound of her knife rattling down through the staircase. She tried to imagine that it could have slipped and fallen on its own. With the light extinguished, her ears seemed to hijack the unused portion of her brain. Her breathing, even her pulse, seemed audible, the whirring of the pump louder now. Tomato in hand, she crouched down and moved toward the other wall, arms stretched out to feel her way. She slid toward the exit, staying low to avoid the plants, trying to calm herself. There were no ghosts here, nothing to be spooked about. She repeated this to herself as she slowly crept forward. And then an arm was on her, reaching over her shoulder. Juliet cried out and dropped the tomato. The arm grabbed her shoulder, pinning her down in a crouch as she tried to stand. She slapped at this intruder, tried to pull away from it, the tablecloth bonnet yanked from her head, until finally she felt the hard steel of the turnstile, one of the waist bars jutting out in the hallway, and felt the fool. "You about gave me a heart attack," she told the machine. She reached for its sides and lifted herself over. She would come back for more food once she had light. Leaving the turnstile and heading for the exit, one hand on the wall and another groping ahead of herself, Juliet wondered if she would start talking to objects now, start going crazy. As the darkness absorbed her, she realized her mindset was changing by the minute. Resigned to her death the day before, now she was frightened of mere insanity. It was an improvement. Her hand finally bumped into the door, and Juliet pushed it open. She cursed the loss of the knife. It was certainly missing from the grating. She wondered how far it might have fallen, if she'd ever find it again, or maybe a replacement. She turned to grab her thermos, and saw that it was missing as well. Juliet felt her vision narrow, her heart quicken. She wondered if the closing of the door could have toppled her thermos. She wondered how the knife had slipped through a gap in the grating narrower than its handle, and as the pounding in her temples receded, she heard something else. Footsteps. Ringing out on the stairwell below her. Running. 14. These violent delights have violent ends. The countertop in supply rattled with the implements of war. Guns, freshly milled and wholly forbidden, were lined up like so many sticks of steel. Knox picked one up, could feel the heat in a barrel recently bored and rifled, and hinged the stock to expose the firing chamber. He reached into one of the buckets of shiny bullets, the casings chopped from thin tubes of pipe and packed with blasting powder, and slotted one into the brand new gun. The operation of the machine seemed simple enough. Point and pull the lever.
"Careful where you aim that," one of the men of supply said, leaning out of the way.
Knox raised the barrel toward the ceiling and tried to picture in his mind what one of these could do. He'd only ever seen a gun once, a smaller one on the hip of that old deputy, a gun he'd always figured was more for show. He stuffed a fistful of deadly rounds in his pocket, thinking how each one could end an individual life, and understanding why such things were forbidden. Killing a man should be harder than waving a length of pipe in their direction. It should take long enough for one's conscience to get in the way. One of the supply workers emerged from the stacks with a tub in his hands. The bend of his back and sag of his shoulders told Knox the thing was heavy.
"Just 2 dozen of these so far,"
the man said, hoisting the bin to the counter. Knox reached inside and pulled out one of the heavy cylinders. His mechanics and even some of the men and women in yellow eyed the bin nervously.
"Slam that end on something hard,"
the man behind the counter said, just as calmly as if he were doling out an electrical relay to a customer and giving some last-minute installation advice.
"Like a wall, the floor, the butt of your gun, anything like that, and then get rid of it."
"Are they safe to carry?" Shirley asked as Knox stuffed one into his hip pocket.
"Oh yeah, it takes some force."
Several people reached their arms in and clattered around for one. Knox caught McLean's eyes as she took one for herself and slotted it into a pocket on her chest. The look on her face was one of cool defiance. She must see how disappointed he was in her coming, and he could tell at a glance that there would be no reasoning with her.
"All right," she said, turning her gray-blue eyes toward the men and women gathered around the counter. "Listen up. We've got to get back open for business, so if you're carrying a gun, grab some ammo. There are strips of canvas over there. Wrap these things up as best you can to keep them out of sight. My group is leaving in 5 minutes, got that? Those of you in the second wave can wait in the back, out of sight."
Knox nodded. He glanced over at Mark and Shirley, both of whom would join him in the second wave. The slower climbers would go first and act casual. The stouter legs would follow and make a strong push, hopefully converging on 34 at the same time. Each group would be conspicuous enough, combined, and they might as well sing their intentions while they marched.
"You okay, boss?"
Shirley rested her rifle on her shoulder and frowned at him. He rubbed his beard and wondered how much of his stress and fear was shining through.
"Fine," he grumbled. Yeah.
Mark grabbed a bomb, stashed it away, and rested a hand on his wife's shoulder. Knox felt a pang of doubt. He wished the women didn't have to get involved, at least the wives. He continued to hope that none of this violence would be necessary, but it was getting harder and harder to pretend as eager hands took up arms. They were, all of them, now capable of taking lives, and he reckoned they were angry enough to do so. McLean stepped through the opening in the counter and sized him up.
"Well, this is it, then."
She reached out a hand. Knox accepted it. He admired the strength in the woman.
"We'll see you on 35 and go up the last level together," he said. Don't have all the fun without us.
She smiled.
Oh, we won't.
And good climbing.
He looked to the men and women gathering up behind her.
All of you, good luck and see you soon.
There were stern nods and clenched jaws. The small army in yellow began to file for the door, but Knox held McLean back.
Hey, he said, no trouble till we catch up, okay?
She slapped his shoulder and smiled.
And when this goes down, Knox said, I expect you at the very back, behind the...
McLean stepped closer, a hand gripping Knox's sleeve. Her wrinkled face had suddenly hardened.
And tell me, where will you be, Knox of Mechanical, when the bombs fly? When these men and women who look up to us are facing their gravest test, where will you be?
Knox was taken back by the sudden attack, this quiet hiss that landed with all the force of a shout.
You know we're all...
He started to answer.
Damn straight, McLean said, releasing his arm. And you'd better well know that I'll see you there.
15. I dreamt my lady came and found me dead. Juliet stood perfectly still and listened to the sound of footsteps retreating down the stairwell. She could feel the vibrations in the railing. Goosebumps rushed up her legs and down her arms. She wanted to call out, to yell for the person to stop, but the sudden rush of adrenaline made her chest feel cold and empty. It was like a chill wind had forced itself deep into her lungs, crowding out her voice. People were alive and in the silo with her, and they were running away. She pushed away from the railing and dashed across the landing, hit the curved steps at a dead run, and took them as fast as her legs could take her. A flight down, as the adrenaline subsided, she found the lungs to yell, "Stop!" But the racket of her bare feet on the metal stairs likely drowned out her voice. She could no longer hear the person running, dared not to stop and listen for fear that they would get too far ahead. But as she passed the doorway on 31, she felt the panic that they might slip inside some level and get away. And if there were only a handful of them, hiding in the vast silo, she may never find them. Not if they didn't want to be found. Somehow, this was more terrifying than anything else, that she might live the rest of her days foraging and surviving in a dilapidated silo, talking to inanimate objects, while a group of people did the same and stayed out of sight. It so stressed her that it took a while to consider the opposite, that this might instead be a group who would seek her out and not have the best intentions. They wouldn't have the best intentions, but they would have her knife. She stopped at 32 to listen. Holding her breath to keep quiet was almost impossible. Her lungs were crying out for deep gulps of air. But she remained still, the pulse in her palms beating against the cool railing, the distinct sound of footsteps still below her and louder now. She was catching up. She took off again, emboldened, taking the steps three at a time, her body sideways as she danced down the stairs as she had in youth, one hand on the curving railing, the other held out in front of her for balance, the balls of her feet just barely touching a tread before she was flying down to the next, concentrating lest she slip. A spill could be deadly at such speeds. Images of casts on arms and legs and stories of the unfortunate elderly with broken hips came to mind. Still, she pushed her limits, positively flying. 33 went by in a blaze. Half a spiral later, over her footfalls, she heard a door slam. She stopped and looked up. She leaned over the railing and peered down. The footfalls were gone, leaving just the sound of her panting for air. Juliet hurried down another rotation of the steps and checked the door on 34. It wouldn't open. It wasn't locked, though. The handle clicked down and the door moved, but caught on something. Juliet tugged as hard as she could, but to no avail. She yanked again and heard something crack. With a foot braced on the other door, she tried a third time, yanking sharply, snapping her head back, pulling her arms toward her chest, and kicking with her foot. Something snapped. The door flew open and she lost her grip on the handle. There was an explosion of light from inside, a bright burst of illumination spilling out the door before it slammed shut again. Juliet scrambled across the landing and grabbed the handle. She pulled the door open and struggled to her feet. One broken half of a broomstick lay inside the hallway. The other half hung from the handle of the neighboring door. Both stood out in the blinding light all around her. The overhead lamps inside the room were fully lit, the bright rectangles in the ceiling marching down the hall and out of sight. Juliet listened for footsteps, but heard little more than the buzzing of the bulbs. The turnstile ahead of her winked its red eye over and over, like it knew secrets but wouldn't tell. She got up and approached the machine, looked to the right where a glass wall peeked into a conference room, the lights full on in there as well. She hopped over the stile, the motion a habit already, and called out another hello. Her voice echoed back, but it sounded different in the lit air, if that were possible. There was life in here, electricity, other ears to hear her voice, which made the echoes somehow fainter. She passed offices, peeking in each one to look for signs of life. The place was a mess. Drawers dumped on the floor, metal filing cabinets tipped over, precious paper everywhere. One of the desks faced her, and Juliet could see that the computer was on, the screen full of green text. It felt as though she'd entered a dream world. In 2 days, assuming she'd slept that long, her brain had gradually acclimated to the pale green glow of the emergency lights, had grown used to a life in the wilderness, a life without power. She still had the taste of brackish water on her tongue, and now she strolled through a disheveled but otherwise normal workplace. She imagined the next shift. Did offices like these have shifts? Returning, laughing from the stairwell, shuffling papers and writing furniture and getting back to work. The thought of work had her wondering what they did here. She had never seen such a layout. She almost forgot about her flight down the stairs as she poked about, as curious about the rooms and power as the footsteps that had brought her here. Around a bend, she came to a wide metal door that, unlike the others, wouldn't open. Juliet heaved on it and felt it barely budge. She pressed her shoulder against the metal door and pushed it, a few inches at a time, until she could squeeze through. She had to step over a tall metal filing cabinet that had been yanked down in front of the heavy door in an attempt to hold it closed. The room was massive, at least as big as the generator room and far larger than the cafeteria. It was full of tall pieces of furniture, bigger than filing cabinets, but with no drawers. Instead, their fronts were covered with blinking lights, red, green, and amber. Juliet shuffled through paper that had spilled from the filing cabinet, and she realized, as she did so, that she couldn't be alone in the room. Someone had pulled the cabinet across the door, and they had to have done this from inside. Hello? She passed through the rows of tall machines, for that's what she figured they were. They hummed with electricity and now and then seemed to whir or clack like their innards were busy. She wondered if this were some sort of exotic power plant, providing the lighting, perhaps. Or did these have stacks of batteries inside? Seeing all the cords and cables at the backs of the units had her leaning toward batteries. No wonder the lights were blaring. This was like 20 of Mechanical's battery rooms combined. "Is anyone here?" she called out. "I mean you no harm." She worked her way through the room, listening for any movement, until she came across one of the machines with its door hinged open. Peering inside, she saw not batteries, but boards like the kind Walker was forever soldering on. In fact, the guts of this machine looked eerily similar to the inside of the dispatch room's computer. Juliet stepped back, realizing what these were. "The servers," she whispered. "She was in this silo's IT. Level 34, of course." There was a scraping sound near the far wall, the sound of metal sliding on metal. Juliet ran in that direction, darting between the tall units, wondering who the hell this was running from her and where they planned to hide. She rounded the last row of servers to see a portion of the floor moving, a section of metal grate sliding to cover a hole. Juliet dove for the floor, her tablecloth garb wrapping up her legs, her hands seizing the edge of the cover before it could close. Right in front of her, she saw the knuckles and fingers of a man's hands gripping the edge of the grate. There was a startled scream, a grunt of effort. Juliet tried to yank back on the grate but had no leverage. One of the hands disappeared. A knife took its place, snicking against the grate, hunting for her fingers. Juliet swung her feet beneath her and sat up for leverage. She yanked on the grate and felt the knife bite into her finger as she did so. She screamed. The man below her screamed. He emerged and held the knife between them, his hand shaking, the blade catching and reflecting the overhead lights. Juliet tossed the metal hatch away and clutched her hand, which was dripping blood. "Easy," she said, scooting out of reach. The man ducked his head down, then poked it back up. He looked past Juliet as if others were coming up behind her. She fought the urge to check, but decided to trust the silence just in case he was trying to fool her.
"Who are you?" she asked.
She wrapped part of her garment around her hand to bandage it. She noticed the man, his beard thick and unkempt, was wearing gray coveralls. They could have been made in her silo, with just slight differences. He stared at her, his dark hair wild and hanging shaggy over his face. He grunted, coughed into his hand, seemed prepared to duck down under the floor and disappear.
"Stay," Juliet said. "I mean you no harm."
The man looked at her wounded hand and at the knife. Juliet glanced down to see a thin trace of blood snaking toward her elbow. The wound ached, but she'd had worse in her time as a mechanic.
Sorry,
the man muttered. He licked his mouth and swallowed. The knife was trembling uncontrollably.
"My name's Jules," she said, realizing this man was much more frightened of her than the other way around. "What's yours?"
He glanced at the knife blade held sideways between them, almost as if checking a mirror. He shook his head.
"No name,"
he whispered, his voice a dry rasp.
"No need."
"Are you alone?" she asked. He shrugged.
"Solo," he said. "Years."
He looked up at her.
"Where did—"
He licked his lips again, cleared his throat. His eyes watered and glinted in the light.
You come from? Well, what level?"
"You've been by yourself for years?" Juliet said in wonder. She couldn't imagine. "I didn't come from any level," she told him. "I came from another silo." She enunciated this last softly and slowly, worried what this news might do to such a seemingly fragile man. But Solo nodded as if this made sense. It was not the reaction Juliet had expected.
The outside?"
Solo looked again at the knife. He reached out of the hole and set it on the grating, slid it away from both of them.
Is it safe?"
Juliet shook her head. "No," she said. "I had a suit. It wasn't a far walk, but still, I shouldn't be alive." Solo bobbed his head. He looked up at her, wet tracks running from the corners of his eyes and disappearing into his beard.
"None of us should," he said. "Not a one."
16. Give leave a while. We must talk in secret. "What is this place?" Lucas asked Bernard. The two of them stood before a large chart hanging on the wall like a tapestry. The diagrams were precise, the lettering ornate. It showed a grid of circles evenly spaced with lines between them and intricacies inside each. Several of the circles were crossed out with thick, red marks of ink. It was just the sort of majestic diagramming he hoped to one day achieve with his star charts.
"This is our legacy," Bernard said simply.
Lucas had often heard him speak similarly of the mainframes upstairs.
"Are these supposed to be the servers?" he asked,
daring to rub his hands across a continuous piece of paper the size of a small bedsheet.
"They're laid out like the servers."
Bernard stepped beside him and rubbed his chin.
Interesting. So they are. I never noticed that before.
What are they?
Lucas looked closer and saw each was numbered. There was also a jumble of squares and rectangles in one corner with parallel lines spaced between them, keeping the blocky shapes separate and apart. These figures contained no detail within them, but the word Atlanta was written large beneath.
We'll get to that. Come, let me show you something.
At the end of the room was a door. Bernard led him through this, turning on more lights as he went.
"Who else comes down here?" Lucas asked, following along.
Bernard glanced back over his shoulder.
"No one."
Lucas didn't like that answer. He glanced back over his own shoulder, feeling like he was descending into something people didn't return from.
"I know this must seem sudden," Bernard said.
He waited on Lucas to join him, threw his small arm around Lucas's shoulder.
"But things changed this morning. The world is changing, and she rarely does it pleasantly."
"Is this about the cleaning?"
He nearly said Juliet. The picture of her felt hot against his breastbone. Bernard's face grew stern.
"There was no cleaning," he said abruptly. "And now all hell will break loose and people will die. And the silos, you see, were designed from the ground down to prevent this."
"Designed?" Lucas repeated. His heart beat once, twice. His brain whirred its old circuits and finally computed something Bernard had said that made no sense.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Did you say silos?"
"You'll want to familiarize yourself with this."
Bernard gestured toward a small desk which had a fragile-looking wooden chair tucked up against it. There was a book on the desk, unlike any Lucas had ever seen or even heard of. It stood nearly as high as it was wide. Bernard patted the cover, then inspected his palm for dust.
"I'll give you the spare key, which you are to never remove from your neck. Come down when you can and read. Our history is in here, as well as every action you are to take in any emergency."
Lucas approached the book, a lifetime's worth of paper, and hinged open the cover. The contents were machine-printed, the ink pitch black. He flipped through a dozen pages of listed contents until he found the first page of the body. Oddly, he recognized the opening lines immediately.
"It's the pact," he said, looking up at Bernard. "I already know quite a bit of..."
"This is the pact,"
Bernard told him, pinching the first half inch of the thick book.
"The rest is the order."
He stepped back. Lucas hesitated, digesting this, then reached forward and flopped the tome open near its middle. "In the event of an earthquake, for casement cracking and outside seepage, turn to airlock breach, page 2180.